All right. As most of you know, I'm really a theory person by training. And as some of you know, about 4.5 years ago, I decided to give myself a challenge and try to start a wet lab. Now I can do an experiment to save my life, although I sort of tried to do one earlier this week. Paul graciously showed me how you actually do something. And so what I did, I tried to find a sort of more senior person to sort of run the wet lab, and I was very lucky to find this guy, American guy called Olin Cylinder, who was basically being in charge of doing the wet lab experiments. And so we collaborate on supervising students. By the way, if you have a senior postdoc that would like such a job, you can have him send his materials to me, because it's very likely that Olin soon be leaving, so I'll be looking for a similarly good person to replace him. And I was also very lucky to find this PhD student, Louise Wolf. So all the experiments I was talking about have been done together with Olin, and Louise has been doing experiments. Now, I've been here before, and I know how talk can go. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to give you the punchline right now, tell you what the punchline is, and then I don't have to worry that I won't get to the end of it. So the project started that we were interested in expression noise in E. coli. So the fact is that different E. coli promoters display different noise levels. And we were interested in trying to investigate how has natural selection acted on promoter noise. Has it tried to minimize it? Is it sort of good to be noisy for some promoters? And how can we find this out? And so the idea we came up with is to evolve a set of synthetic promoters from random sequences under controlled selection conditions in the lab, so we know precisely what we're selecting them for, measure their noise properties, compare the noise properties with native promoters, and in this way try to learn something about what natural selection has done in native promoters. And then what we found to our surprise is that instead of lowering noise, selection has acted to increase noise in a substantial fraction of the promoters. So you can get to ask a question by the time I get to the end of these 4 points. And we then looked at what's special about native E. coli promoters that are noisy, and we found that there's a general correlation between a promoter being noisy and a promoter being regulated. And then we were interested to ask, well, is that just an unavoidable side effect of regulation, the fact that these promoters are noisy? They want to be regulated, they don't want to be noisy, but they can't avoid it. Or is there maybe some gate hedging going on that is actually beneficial for these promoters to be noisy? And then, as I will try to explain to you, we think the answer is both. And so I developed a little theory for the evolution of gene regulation that basically, the point is that the transmission of noise from a regulator to its target is often functional, not just a detrimental side effect, could be a good thing for you. And this, interestingly, allows for very smooth evolution of finely tuned gene regulation, where you can evolve gene regulation that starts out as having only noise increase as a benefit, and then you can fine tune it over time to turn into much more finely tuned regulation. So that's the story. I got it out of the way. So now, start.
No, go ahead. It's going to come later.
Okay. Good. All right. So if you want to measure expression noise in E. coli, we generally use for this fluorescent reporters. So a number of years ago, the lab of Uri Alon made a library of plasmids that have this green fluorescent protein, and upstream of this protein is cloned in the promoter sequence of every promoter from the E. coli genome. Okay, so there's a library. And now what you can do is you can then grow cells that have been transformed with one of these plasmids under a microscope, look at them, and by basically looking at the variation in fluorescence from cell to cell, you get a sense of the noise of this promoter. And you can also do this in more high throughput in a fax machine. So the way that this works probably almost all of you know, is that basically cells move through a flow channel one by one, they pass in front of a laser, then there's a detector that detects the level of fluorescence of each cell. And then what is important for later is that based on the fluorescence measured, you can tell the fax machine to only select cells whose fluorescence levels lie in a certain interval. All right, so you can use that to select out individual cells that have a certain range of fluorescences. Okay, so what does this data look like? So here's two examples of two promoters where we take a picture under the microscope, and I'm also showing you the distribution of log fluorescence in the fax machine. And we find that for the vast majority of promoters, the distribution of log fluorescence is very close to a log normal distribution. So you can characterize this distribution by a mean and a standard deviation or a variance.
How many copies of the plasmid does the cell have?
Yeah, so we think it's actually difficult to measure, but we think it's about 6, 7. It's a low copy number plasmid.
So what's the variability of the copy number?
Yes, so it's like almost these question answers, the first question that was. We don't know precisely, but it must be low. No, because, I mean, if there was a twofold variation, then there would be at least a twofold variation. And basically, we get, as you will see, clones where the variation is just a few percent gene expression level. So
it's lower than the lowest.
So if it's 5%, then, you know, the plasmid copy number variation cannot be more than that. All right. So we, of course, would like to know absolutely when we measure a certain fluorescence from a cell, how many GFP molecules does that correspond to? So we did some calibration experiments using quantitative measurements and quantitative westerns and reference amounts of GFP. And from that, we can work out a relationship between the fluorescence intensity in the fax and the number of GFP molecules per cell. And it looks reasonably nicely linear, and so we know that in the sort of the lowest expressed promoters that we look at, we have maybe 400 molecules of GFP per cell, and in the highest ones, about 100,000 molecules of GFP per cell. Does GFP level reflect transcription rate? The way Alon's group made these constructs, the intention was to only measure transcription, to not measure variation in translation or mRNA stability. So all these GFPs, they have their own ribosome binding site upstream of them, which is a very strong ribosome binding site. Now, of course, there is still some variation because depending on where the transcription start is, the beginning of the mRNA is not exactly the same in each of these constructs. So we wanted to see how much influence does that have on expression level. And so what we did is we used qPCR to measure mRNA, relative mRNA levels for 96 strains. So these qPCR measurements are unfortunately very noisy, but you see there's a pretty good correlation between mRNA level and log GFP per cell. And if you, and so we know that, okay, so the difference between the protein and the mRNA level is given by translation rate and protein decay rate, but the GFP is very stable, so the effective protein decay is just dilution. These cells will grow at the same rate. So the variation in the deviation from this straight line here is all due to variation in translation rate. And so we can measure how much there is. And for the large majority, there is between, you know, one e-fold up and down of the average. So there is some variation, but it's not very large. All right, so this is now what we get. So Olin already been doing these kind of measurements for a while. There's a paper published 2 years ago. This is actually what I'm showing you here. It's new data. It's essentially the same kind of measurements. So each dot in this plot is a E. coli promoter. On the x-axis is the mean log fluorescence of this promoter. and on the y-axis is the variance in log fluorescence, okay, across cells in the population. So, you know, for each of these models, you measure tens of thousands of cells. So as you see, there is some funky stuff going on here. This black line corresponds to an empty cell, so a cell without a plasmid, and also plasmids where there is no promoter insert. Okay, so this is background fluorescence here. And this second line here is two times the background fluorescence. So these cells here, the fluorescence coming from the GFP molecule is less than the background fluorescence coming from the cell. And the variation that you get there is due variation in cell sizes that, you know, we select in the FOX cells of a particular size, but there will still be some variation. And so, to make a long story short, I don't really understand what sets this curve. Okay? So we decide for all our studies to focus on those promoters where the fluorescence due to GFP is at least as large as the background.
So this is log base E.
Yes. All right. So what you now notice is that, of course, there is a large range of mean expression levels and there is a large range of variances. But there is a clear dependency between mean and variance. In particular, there seems to be a very tight lower bound on your variance as a function of mean test.
So in your FACT experiments, you have a threshold and you select cells that are above certain threshold.
Yeah, I'm not there yet. This is just taking all native promoters and looking what they do. The evolution is going to come later. Yeah.
So these are all independent individual promoters.
Yes.
For every single one.
Yes.
Okay. And these are consensus, non-consensus, including different distances between.
No, these are just all the real promoters that E. coli K12 MG1655
cloned directly before GFP.
GFP, some spacer, ribosome binding site, promoter in front.
In the chromosome.
Plasmid, low copy number plasmid.
Why not the chromosome?
Because in the experiments we're going to do in the evolution is impossible. And we want to be able to compare directly, quantitatively, with the native promoters, with the promoters we're going to evolve in the same setting, on the same plasmid, in the same background cells. So we've done this, Olin has done this for a few dozen, two dozen or so, I think, promoters. We put them in the chromosome and check that, you know, these things correlate well with each other and those you get on the plasmid in the chromosome.
On the chromosome, you also get copy number.
Yes, you also do. Yes, I know. I'm very happy you say that.
So this is the absolute variance.
Yes.
Log intensity.
Log of absolute variance.
No. The variance in log intensities.
So it's a full change variance.
Yes.
They're quite small, so as far as the, you know, it's the relative variance is not that different for most of these points.
Yes. Yes, exactly. Right. So you can think of it certainly down here as relative variance. All right, so the question is, can we understand, because it's difficult now to compare, let's say, this noise level with this noise level over here, given that there is this systematic dependence on mean. So we first want to sort of understand the systematic dependence on mean and see if we can normalize for it. So this actually turns out not to be so hard. So if you take the sort of simplest model of stochastic transcription, you basically assume there is some constant rate, mu zero, at which you transcribe a new mRNA. For each mRNA, then there is a rate, mu one, of translation per unit time, so that you make a new protein per unit time. There's a rate, d zero, per mRNA per unit time for decay of the mRNA. And when you have the protein, then there's also a certain rate, d one, of protein decay per unit time. If all these things are constant, all these four rates, then it turns out the distribution of protein copy numbers per cell, as you know, this paper by Peter Swain shows, is given by a negative binomial that depends only on these two ratios, A and B. And the way you should think about this is that A is essentially, so D1 is the protein decay rate, which I just told you is really the dilution rate. So the ratio mu zero D1 is the average number of transcripts you make per generation. D, which is sometimes also called Earth size, is the average number of times an mRNA is translated before it decays. So it's how many copies do you, how many proteins do you produce per mRNA before the mRNA decays. The mean number of proteins per cell is A times B, and the variance is N, is the mean, times B plus 1. So this is like Poisson noise, right, with the variance equal to the mean, but there is this multiplication factor B, because basically you amplify each mRNA.
B presumably has a substantial relatively broad distribution as well.
Sorry?
B presumably has a relatively broad distribution as well, so the variance of the
combination. Yeah, I'll come to that in a second. So this is what you would get if these rates were completely constant. But now, probably due to variation in nucleases, ribosomes, polymerase, and so on, these four rates each also fluctuate from cell to cell. And so we're going to make the assumption that because you take the product of fluctuating quantities, that's log normally distributed. So in addition to this noise, this variance, there is an additional variance that is given by the fluctuation in these rates and that is going to scale with the mean squared. Right. So importantly, when the mean becomes large, the fluctuations due to the fluctuations in these rates becomes bigger than the fluctuations due to the Poisson loss. So if you then take that model, and now you go to GFP signal, then the GFP signal in a cell will be some background GFP plus the mean plus some varying quantity, so fluctuating quantity epsilon with mean 0 and variance 1 times this variance that I've just written as a function of n. And then if you calculate what does that correspond to in log scale, and you take the assumption that log down here, you can basically assume that the mean is large relative to the fluctuations, then this is the functional form you get. And so there's really two variables that we don't know. So the background we've measured, so that's fixed. So there's two numbers we don't know, B and this variance due to fluctuations in A and B. So that is really the offset here. This number here is the offset that you go to for very large mean fluorescence. And the B sets the curvature of this curve. All right, so there's basically...
What you're measuring is sort of an average B, then, right? So you fit parameter.
Yes.
And do you think that the lifetime of RNA does depend on all kinds of things, right?
Yes, but so it basically, as I tried to show with these measurements of the qPCR, these constructs are made in such a way so as to sort of minimize the variation that these mRNA stability and translation rates will have. So I think it's not unreasonable to assume that they're pretty close. Yeah.
So B should be is to be interpreted as the number of times a single mRNA is translated, or
before it decays, yes, on average.
On average.
Because it's all Poisson, right?
Okay. So this thing is translated 400 times.
Yes, it's a very strong ribosomal binding site. It translates very well. Okay. So now what you can do is you can simply subtract this curve from this scatter, and then you get this scatter here. And so basically you see that you've now quite reasonably removed any correlation between mean and this excess variance. So we call the excess variance how much more variance a promoter has relative to this minimal variance as a function of its mean. All right. So now the question is, so when you see that there are many promoters whose noise is pretty close to this lower bound, but there is also a number of guys here that have much higher noise. And so the question is, how has selection acted on this? And I think most people would say that what they think is going on is that noise is intrinsically bad. In each condition, each gene has some optimal expression level, and any kind of variability away from this optimal expression level is bad, so selection will have acted to try and lower the noise. And basically what you see here is all these guys are bunching up to this sort of lower bound that you physically cannot go below. And then maybe some of these guys up here that have much higher noise, there's basically promoters where you don't care as much. So drift has been able to push it up because selection has not selected so strongly against them. But as many of you know, there are also arguments made that maybe in certain conditions, in fluctuating environments, it can be good to be noisy. It's like a bat hatching strategy. It's good to have variability in the population. And so we were wondering, how can we tell the two things apart? So what we decided to do to assess this role of selection, we will compare the behavior of these native promoters with synthetic promoters that we evolved in a carefully controlled environment.
But you have genes of unknown function things included in there?
I think so, yeah. I mean, I think they try to put everything, every intergenic region over some size. So there are about 1,500 constructs or something here. We don't have everything, and for some there's problems with mapping and so on, so there's some holes, but I think there's something to unknown function. All right, so, yeah.
Would you spend a minute saying what the outliers are, like the first two highest? Just for, because there are not many, right? There are
yeah.
Which dominate the feature.
There are, so I don't remember now. Lac Z is certainly noisy in these conditions. I know there are some genes that have to do with the response to acid stress. I mean, I'm happy to look at it with you, but I mean, there's no very simple story. It's not like all the top 20 are all in this pathway or something like this. Okay, so what we did is we took essentially the same plasmid, but instead of putting the real promoters from E. coli upstream, we went to a company and asked them to make us completely random fragments of DNA of between 100 and 150 base pairs long. And so we got such a collection, and so we cloned those completely random sequences upstream. Then we transformed cells with them. Then we went to the FACS machine, and we picked some target expression level, and then we selected promoter sequences that were expressing close to that level. Then we took the cells back out, the plasmids out of the cells, and then because there are restriction enzyme sites here, we can get all the just the fragments back out, and then we use error-prone PCR to multiply the selected fragments. Then we put them onto fresh plasmids, put them into fresh cells, and we did this 5 times. Okay, so 5 rounds. It's very important that the only thing that gets to evolve here is this sequence, or these sequences. Everything else is kept constant, cannot change.
So you sequence, you make sure that the rest is constant?
No, just in the strength over the
thank you. all right, so this is what it looks like. So we took 2 target levels. One target level that we chose is the medium expression level of all alone clones. Okay, so all native clones we took sort of halfway, and we say this is medium expression. And so this is the initial population. Most of this is background, but there is some stuff here that's actually expressed. Actually, it's not really even that small a fraction. And in each round, we always select the 5% of the population that is closest to the target level. So in the first round, this was the selection window we set in the FACS, because this is 5% of the population.
How many sequences are there in your pool?
In the initial pool, we think about 1 million unique random sequences in the initial pool. All right, so then if you take the selected ones, do error-prone PCR, and measure them again, this is the expression distribution you get. So you see there's still junk here, but you've already moved your population there. So the second window, this was 5%. In the second round, then we got this. This is 5%. Fourth round, 5th round. So you see basically by round 3 you were there, and you're no longer evolving. So it takes you basically 2 rounds to get promoters with medium expression level.
How many mutations do you have in each of these rounds?
So we set the error-prone PCR so that there is sort of 1, 2, 3 mutations per fragment per generation. That's what we aimed for, and it's sort of what we got. If you ask, so here, the second one, we ask for high expression. So this is actually the 97th percentile. It's a ribosomal protein. And so we ask for a very high level. So it takes longer. But you basically get close to this level. And in this distribution, there are promoters here that express at a higher level than any native promoter in E. coli. And so this is in 5 rounds. All right, so now, see, these were populations, right? So this is the distribution of fluorescence in the population in each generation. So it's a mixture of many different genotypes. So now we took out 378 clones from the third and fifth generation, and we sequenced them, and we found that the sequences are highly diverse. So I will not talk at all today about the sequence. We have all the sequences, but we're not really done analyzing it, so not talk about it. And then what we did is we measured expression distributions for these individual clones, for these sort of individual promoters. And here are some examples. So here are some examples of distributions of promoters that were selected for medium expression. Here are some promoters that were evolved for high expression. And now the question is, how do the noise levels that these promoters show compare with the noise levels that the native E. coli promoters show? So that's what this graph shows. So our synthetic promoters are the red dots in this graph. And here you see a cumulative distribution of this excess noise. So the red are our synthetic promoters, and the black are native promoters. And so to our surprise, we find that basically virtually all our promoters are near this low noise band. And their noise distribution at low noise is pretty much the same as the native promoters. But there are native promoters with significantly higher noise levels than the ones we get. Okay? Yes.
What typical variants do you
get to? In great detail, we'll tell you about.
How long are the native promoters compared to the synthetic promoters?
They're a bit longer. They're a bit longer. So in E. coli, you know, sort of, they start from, let's say, 80 base pairs wide, native promoters, and they go to 300-something. And ours are all between 100 and 150.
And so is there any correlation between noisy ones and having a longer promoter?
Very, very, very weak. It's not completely absent, but there is there isn't. There is a slight correlation between mean expression and length. But as far as I know, there's no correlation with the noise. All right, so what's the interpretation? Yes?
Do you weed out the intergenic regions in which small RNAs have been identified, and alternate gene regulation methods have been identified in E. coli? That is, in the original set.
No, I don't think so. But I mean, as you will see later on, I don't think that is the main explanation for the higher noise level. I'm not saying that it couldn't contribute, but I don't think it's the bulk explanation. All right. So what is now the interpretation of the fact that our synthetic promoters have lower noise than the native ones? And one possibility is that maybe, and I think Natalie was sort of alluding to this, but maybe we're strongly selecting against noise in our promoters. Right? If we set these very tight windows, then we're effectively selecting promoters that are low noise themselves. So we try to look at this carefully. So let me just first say sort of theoretically how this would work. So if you have a log normal distribution of expression levels in your population, so your population is characterized, so a promoter is characterized by a mean and standard deviation, and the probability that one cell from this promoter will have expression level X is simply a Gaussian in this log scale with mean mu and variance sigma squared. So that's the blue curve. And now our selection window, we will make the assumption, I will show you in a minute that this is actually a pretty good assumption, is that if we set the target window here at mu star, that's the target expression level, and we set the width of the window to some variable tau, then the probability that a cell that has fluorescence level X will be selected in the FACS is simply also falling as a Gaussian, and let's assume that it's one if you have the exact right expression level, and it falls as x goes away from this target level with some characteristic with tau. Okay? So now, if that's the case, then the fitness of a promoter with mean mu and standard deviation sigma is essentially, you know, roughly the area under the particle distance curves. And of course, because these are all Gaussians, you can nicely calculate this analytically, so you get an expression like this. Okay? So this is the fitness fraction of selection cells of a promoter with a certain mean invariant. So what, just quickly review, what are the properties of such a fitness function? It's very simple. Well, yes, it's relatively simple. So first, it's always good to move the mean of your promoter to the desired mean. Okay, so if you started from some popular distribution here, and you shift your mean towards the desired level, the area under this curve will always increase, so it's always good to shift your mean towards the desired level. This is intuitive. Once you are at the desired mean, so notice this blue curve is now centered at the target level, then it will be beneficial to lower your noise, right? Because if you lower your noise and you get a tighter distribution, then more of your population will fall inside the window. So if you're at the optimal mean, you want minimal noise. That's also what you expect. But you should notice that if for a reason or other you find yourself at the wrong mean, then it might not be a good idea to lower your noise, right? So you might reduce the amount of intersection with the target window. And so it's a simple calculation to show that if you're at a certain distance, as you increase the distance between the mean and the target level, there's basically a bifurcation where the optimal noise level goes from zero to some non-zero value. And basically, the optimal noise level sigma star is given by the fact by that sigma star squared plus the width of this window, tau squared, is equal to the square deviation, right, between your level and the target level. All right, so that's the fitness function. And now what we like to do is we like to figure out what are actually the mu and tau, right, this mu and tau of the selection window that we are actually using in our fox. And the way we figure this out is by taking populations and then performing a round of selection without doing any mutation, and measure the distribution of noise levels before and after selection. And we did selection at three levels. So either we set a wide window where we selected 25%, or the normal, which is 5%, that was used during evolution, or a tight window where it's 1%. And then basically by using the fact that most promoters lie in this band here, certainly the synthetic ones, you can work out what is the distribution of means in your population and predict what should selection do, and then you compare it with selection action does. And so these wiggly curves are the actually observed distributions, and the straight lines are the fitted ones, and you see that this model that assumes that the selection window is a Gaussian shape quite accurately describes the way the population distribution shifts. So we can actually pull out what is mu and tau in our system. So we know now, for a promoter that has a certain mean and variance, what will be its fitness in our facts. So that's what I'm plotting here. So this contour plots, this is for the, these are for God. So these dots are all promoters you observe. These are from round 5, these are from round 3. Here's the mean expression level. Here's the variance, x is variance. And the contour plot shows you fitness. All right, so if you're here, 1% of your cells is selected. Here, 2, 3, 4, 5, up to 8%. Right? And so you see that your fitness is best when you're at the expression level about 8, that was the target level. And it drops very quickly as you go to the left or right of it. And it drops much more slowly as you go up in noise. Right? So what this shows us is that effectively we're not selecting for noise. Right? And we show this in a number of different ways. If you provide additional rounds of selection without mutation, we're not appreciably shifting the noise level distributions. And another way in which you can see that is you could take all the clones that we have and calculate what is their fitness as a function of their mean, and you see that it's a very well-defined function as a function of their mean. But if you look at, is there any correlation between the excess noise of promoters and their fitness, there's none. All right? So basically, the result of all this analysis is that we haven't selected our promoters for low noise. Low noise is just the default state you get when you start from random sequences and ask them to express at one expression level.
It looks like you have some kind of negative
correlation over there. Yeah, but that's because if it's a subtle thing, right? So there is a good correlation between mean and excess variance. Sorry, between mean and fitness. And then this curve, now I have to think again. Okay, I can't reconstruct it now. But I think it's an induced correlation that comes from the correlation with mean.
But isn't it, when you are close to the, when your mean is close to the right one,
yes.
But then variance costs.
Yeah, but it's just very little. That's the thing, right? Yes. The thing is that there's a lower bound that you can't go below. And at this lower bound, yes, so if you're here, you'll much rather be here than there, right? This is 8, 7, 6% fitness. So it goes down a bit. But if you, but the moment you're here, say, you see that this contour runs almost vertical. And up, and your optimal noise is somewhere here, and only here that it slowly starts bending. So it's just in the parameter regime where we are, this effect is just not much.
Sorry?
Yeah.
Question. Could it be that, what's the sample size for your synthetic promoters again? How many did you check in the synthetic promoters?
So every round it's 100,000 that are selected.
The diagram what you've shown, I mean, there were many outliers in the natural system, and I guess these outliers would highly skew your noise level distribution, right?
No, but I mean, I mean, this is the cumulative distribution of the native and the synthetic ones. That's what it is. I mean, you can put a p-value.
The sample size between those native and synthetic promoters, it's the same sample size, or?
What?
I mean, what I'm trying to say.
378 red dots.
And how many?
1,500 black dots. You don't think this is significant?
Actually, I'm asking for that, yeah.
Well, it's 10 to the minus 10 or something, if you do a hypergeometric test.
You see, it's not driven by, let's say, the first five outliers, right? Otherwise.
No. It's don't. It's really significant. All right. So the inference that we then have to make from this is that these guys that are down below are basically sort of in the default state and have really not, there's no evidence that they have been selected for low noise, and instead something must have happened to push these guys up. Okay? Because you don't get that just by nothing. Yes?
I don't know if it's relevant or not. So how heritable is this noise if you get a single cell, not looking at distribution of expression, but like a single cell and kind of the progeny? Do you see her?
Noise is not defined for a single cell, right?
I know, but I mean, do you know any studies of that sort to actually look at the noise and the heritability of noise? Because then that, is there any selection on the noise in that way? So
what do you mean with heritability of noise?
You could have a multi-stable system like the original node become linear experiments where some cells had one level of expression. And then other cells have another.
You're asking for correlation time of the expression level of individual cells.
Yeah.
Okay. We'd like to measure that. I haven't measured that, but I know like Mike Elowitz and so on have measured such things. And Peter Swain told me it's like 1-2 generations correlation length. But I was very interested to hear Tom Norman say that that's when cells are very, very happy. If you make cells a bit less happy, they become much, A, much more variable, and B, the correlation times become much, much longer. So cells can get stuck in one state or another state.
How happy are your cells?
These are happy. These are minimal media with glucose.
And how long after saturation? And does that differ?
No, this is in exponential phase. So yeah, we take them in middle of exponential phase. Huh?
And you did the native promote. These are your measures, both of these, the red and the black. Or are you comparing?
Yeah, we measured all of these in the exact same way.
Yeah,
same plasmid, same background, everything the same.
But it is worth pointing out that in things like budding yeast, the number of generations you have to keep cells in exponential growth for to make all sorts of weird variation disappear is surprisingly low, like 20 plus, which is much less than most people do when they just start.
Good point. We can look at that.
So where is mid exponential for you? Is that very expensive to do?
I can come back to you with the data. Huh?
1.2, I gave, I'm pretty sure it was.
0.1, sure.
0.1.
Okay. Can you? Yeah, I can explain.
All right. So, next question. What is special about these promoters with high noise? Okay, so we try to look at what can we find that native promoters that are high noise, what is special about them? And there's basically two things that stand out. So, first, you can go to some database of microarray experiments in E. coli. So people have measured E. coli gene expression in many different conditions, and there's a database, 240 different conditions. And so you get, for each gene, you get the average, the population average expression level across all these conditions, and then we essentially calculated the variance of this for each gene. So it's a measure of how much does the gene vary across different environments in its mean expression level. So what you see in this curve is what we did is I sorted all promoters by their excess noise, with the most noisy promoter at the top and the least noisy promoter at the bottom. And then I say, what if you take only the highest noisy promoter? What is the mean and standard error of the variance in the expression of that promoter across conditions? It's plasticity. And then as you go down the list, you include more and more and more promoters, and here you include all promoters. Okay, so if you take all genes, this is the mean variation in RNA level across environments. And you see, as you restrict yourself to more and higher noise promoters, this number goes up.
Is the log, the defiance of the log?
This is the mean, yes, this is the mean log phase 2 or E. Fold. So it's like a log fold change.
This is variance across conditions, not variance within conditions.
No, variance of the mean,
yeah,
across conditions. Yeah. And this relationship between noise and plasticity, as people call this, has all been observed in yeast. So this is also true in E. coli. And second, for you, it's a nice collection of known regulatory interactions, right? So there's a data with known transcription factor binding sites in promoters for 185 different E. coli transcription factors. And so you can play the same game where you now ask, what is the number of regulatory inputs starting from all genes and restricting yourself more and more to the highest noise genes? And you see that there is also a very good correlation between excess noise and the number of regulatory inputs that you have. And maybe this is even a better plot. This is the cumulative distribution of noise levels for our synthetic promoters. In black is for promoters that have no known regulatory inputs. Blue, one known regulatory input, and red, two or more known regulatory inputs. All right? So it's, yes.
Shouldn't the values on the graph on the right be quantum? How do you have 1.5 regulatory inputs?
This is the mean across a set of promoters and standard error.
So for that, the plot on the right is, it seems to me like there's heavily biased towards, when you're doing these microarray studies or whatever, you're heavily biased towards
stressful condition. So what you're really asking is, what's the difference in expression in stress versus non-stress condition?
Yeah.
Do you think
maybe. Yeah, okay, so that I certainly threw here.
Yeah.
But here I'm looking at binding sites with transcription factors.
Okay.
So that's, now of course, the transcription factors we know about are the ones that were discovered in the experiments that people have done. So yes, so there's always some, you know, bias.
So that could be an alternative explanation for why you're getting this correlation between the noise, because one idea would be that you have noise because you're prepared, you know, it's a bet hedging mechanism, and those same mechanisms are used for are used to prepare when there's actually sensing. And you encounter a harsh environment, and then you turn on all those same genes, right?
Okay. So let's just see. You know, I'll give you my explanation, and then at the end, you'll tell me if it's the same as what you just said or different. Because it sounds, I mean, the right terms are appearing, but I'm not sure I understand. So then the question is: so why is there this general association between expression noise and regulation? And so just to say what is sort of there's a literature about this, of course, and I think based on results in yeast, one sort of viewpoint that is out there is that noise is just an unavoidable side effect of regulation, okay? So any regulator has itself some noise associated with it, and this noise will necessarily be transmitted to its targets. You can't avoid that. And so some people, for example, especially Kuniko Kaneko, have argued that the association between plasticity and expression and noise is basically a biological version of fluctuation dissipation theorems in physics. All right? If you're a gene and it needs to be highly regulated, you need to couple to many regulators, so you're now going to couple to the fluctuations of these regulators. You can't avoid showing more fluctuations yourself. All right, and in this view, this is not something you like. It's actually something you don't like, but you can't avoid it. However, there's also a whole literature that says, well, in many conditions, phenotypic, if you have fluctuating environments, and especially if the environment changes in unpredictable ways or fast ways, then it might be good to have phenotypic diversity in the population. This is called this bet hedging, and you know, there's papers going back quite some time. And here's one that I was very similar in some recent, more recent work from Stan Lieber and Ivo Kosov. So what I would now like to argue is that actually it's both. Okay. I believe that both of these things are true at the same time, and that's the explanation of what we see. So let's now go. So now data is sort of done, almost. And now I'll tell you about sort of the theoretical ideas. So the idea is that in its natural habitat, the organism experiences different environments, E, and assume in each environment there is some optimal expression level, mu E. All right? So this was the situation in one environment, right? This was the distribution of the population expression levels. This was how selection was acting, and the fitness was basically this surface here. And now we have three environments. So the red environment wants lower expression, and the green environment wants higher expression. And so in each environment, you still have a fitness function that we'll assume has this Gaussian form. But now your overall fitness is basically the geometric average of the fitness in all your environments. Or in a log scale, the total log fitness is the average of the log fitness in each environment. And because these are all nice Gaussians and so on, you can calculate this analytically. And you see that the result, the key quantity here is the average square deviation between the mean expression level of your promoter and the desired expression level in each of the environments relative to the width of both the selection and your noise, right? So this is the sum of your noise and the width. So if you now have no regulation, what would be your optimal mean invariance? Not surprisingly, you will set your mean to the mean of the desired expression levels across environments. And you will set your variance, basically, the optimal variance is equal to the variation in desired expression levels across conditions minus this width of the selection window, right? How tight you're selecting. So essentially, if you assume that selection is quite tight, then basically, if you don't have, if you have a constant mean, you want to set your variance to precisely how much the desired expression levels vary across conditions. That's what you show here, right? You would make your distribution so wide that it covers all environments. Right, so that's the basic bet hedging scenario. But you may ask, wouldn't it be a better idea to just evolve gene regulation instead of doing this? Can't you regulate genes? So what is the idea? So the gene without gene regulation is doing quite well in this environment, but it's doing very bad in that environment. And now it would be really great if somewhere in the genome was a transcription factor such that the activity of this transcription factor was higher in the green environment. That this is the activity of the factor in the green environment, in the yellow, and in the red environment. Now if you evolve a binding site for this regulator, now you can make your mean expression of your promoter dependent on the environment and shift up in the green environment and shift down in the red environment. Right? So that's the idea of regulation. You can do better than just become noisy by finding a regulator who correlates with your desires. Right? That's the idea. So you can actually now put this into the model. So what we will do is we assume that when the gene evolves a binding site for a certain regulator R, its expression across environments E is affected in two ways. So first, the mean expression level of your promoter in environment E is now your original mean times a coupling constant plus a coupling constant times the mean expression of the regulator in that environment. But because any regulator will have some variance, some noise associated with it, your variance will be your original variance plus the coupling constant squared times the variance in the regulator. All right, so you couple to the regulator's noise, and I call this the noise transmission effect. Okay, so a good regulator is one whose means RE accurately track your desired level of mu E, and the amount by which your noise increases when you couple to a regulator depends both on the coupling constant and how noisy the regulator is. Okay, so if you...
Can you go back to the slide before that? It seems like intuitively, if the distributions were as narrow as you have them there with the regulator's expression, you're completely hosed. Right? Your fitness depends on being within those narrow bars.
Yeah.
And therefore, as you evolve the regulator to do its job precisely, you want high noise levels to make sure there's at least some overlap.
Yes, but you should imagine, it's a very good question, you should imagine that that width is the width of your fitness over the time scale over which your expression is correlated. So that's not just necessarily half an hour, but it can be a much longer period of time, and it's the integrated fitness in that environment over that period of time. Make sense?
Yep. I guess it still seems like you want to maximize.
For the theory, the only thing that really matters is that the fitness distribution in an environment, if you multiply that by your expression distribution and integrate, that you can basically do a Laplace approximation of the integral. That is, you know, take the log and expand it to second order around the peak. If I can make that approximation, then everything will go through. That's basically from a mathematical point of view, the approximation is made. All right. So,
Andrew, you're raising the question about is there some expression level in the population, but it's too narrow distribution, and there's nothing in the population that you can select on for the value you want.
Yeah.
So the size of the population, I think, is here that matters. And if you have this distribution, you're trying to come way down here on the log scale, you're trying to select something out here, but you don't have any effect. So if it's
yes.
really narrow,
yes.
you can't.
Sure.
Yes.
Sure. All right. So, okay. So if you can do, you can plug this now, the fitness, you can calculate the fitness with regulation, and it turns out that you can calculate all this analytically. And the final fitness of your promoter coupled to a regulator is a function of only four parameters. So the first parameter, y, I call the expression mismatch. And y squared is the variance in desired levels relative to the sum of the width of the selection window plus your original noise when you were unregulated. It basically tells you how unhappy you are if you're unregulated. It tells you how many standard deviations on average is the desired level away from the one you have. Okay, so that's why. The second is the regulator signal to noise. How much does the mean level of the regulator vary across environments relative to the noise of the regulator in any one environment? So a high signal to noise is a very precise regulator, low signal to noise is a noisy regulator. There's a coupling constant, how strong do you couple? And finally, there's the correlation between the desired levels, mu e, and the actual expression levels of the factor, re. Okay? So as a function of those four parameters, this is your fitness. So now I want to look at the following scenario. You start with an unregulated promoter that wants to increase its fitness. There are different regulators in the genome. Each has a certain correlation R and a certain signal-to-noise ratio S. And the question is, if I now optimally couple to such a regulator, what fitness can I attain? I basically want to look at what kind of regulator would I like to couple to. All right, so this is the fitness surface you get. So here on the bottom is the signal-to-noise of the regulator. So over here are noisy regulators. Over here are very precise regulators. Here's the correlation between the regulator's expression and your desired expression levels. Here there's no correlation, here there's perfect correlation. If you wouldn't regulate, your fitness would be over here. Okay, so this would be the low end. And as you see, the highest fitness you can get, not surprisingly, when you find the regulator that is highly correlated with your desires and that is itself has a pretty high signal-to-noise ratio, is pretty accurate. So if you couple to such a regulator, here's an example. So this regulator indeed goes up in the green environment and red in the down in the red environment just like you want. And if you couple at an optimal coupling strength in this regulator, this will be the populations, your promoter's expression levels in the three environments. So clearly this is the best scenario for you. But many cases there may not be such a regulator in the genome that has 95% correlation with what you want. And interestingly enough, if you go on the other end of the scale here, so here's a regulator that has no correlation whatsoever with your desires. Correlation coefficient is zero, and it's a fairly noisy regulator. Okay? So this is the distribution of the activity of the regulator in this condition. But if now optimally coupled to this, you basically get this scenario here. So by basically coupling to this regulator, you're implementing a bad hedging scenario for this promoter, and it still does a lot better than you did without the regulator.
You're using it as a random number generator.
Precisely. Okay. And what is interesting is that here I have a case where I have a moderately correlated regulator. This regulator has about 0.64 correlation with your desires. Right? So it goes down in the red condition, that's good, but instead of being highest in the green condition as you want, it's highest in the yellow condition. Right? And so when you now couple to this regulator, the fitness that you can attain is actually lower than the fitness that you can attain when you couple to this complete noise regulator. All right? So what this shows is to outdo this, you have to go to very high correlations. Otherwise, the fitness you can get by coupling to just noise is actually better. And so why is the fitness that you get when you couple to this guy lower than when you couple to that guy? It's because that guy is too precise. All right.
Yes, I would claim that that's what I was saying, looking at your slide before. Exactly this.
But this is a feature of the regulator.
Yeah.
Right? This regulator is...
The regulator has to be noisy.
Right, exactly. So you can work out, as a function of the correlation that the regulator has with your desires, what would be its optimal signal to noise. That's this red curve here. So there is an asymptote here. At some point when you have very high correlations, you want to just have a regulator that's as accurate as you can possibly get. This is the regime where noise is really a side effect of regulation, and it's a detrimental side effect of regulation. But everywhere here, as soon as you're not, you know, above 0.95 or so correlation, really an optimal signal to noise, and the signal to noise may be actually quite low in any case. Yes?
Like more global regulator transcription factors to be noisier?
Yeah, okay. Let's talk about it offline. Okay, so the summary of this is coupling to an uncorrelated and noisy regulator can often be beneficial. To outcompete coupling to such a noisy regulator, you need high correlation and signal to noise. And regulators that only moderately correlate with the desired levels of their client promoters will be under selection to decrease their accuracy, to become more noisy. All right, so now you can do one more calculation. So here, instead of just taking a regulator with a certain R correlation and a certain signal to noise, and then finding the optimal coupling constant, I'm varying how unhappy the unregulated promoter was, and I'm varying the correlation that it has, but I'm optimizing everything else. So I'm taking an optimal signal to noise of the regulator, and I'm taking an optimal coupling, and I say, what will be the final noise level of this promoter? Okay? And in that space, you will get a nice phase transition. So when you're in the regime where Y is less than 1, so if the variation is basically less than 1 standard deviation, you don't bother. You don't bother to be regulated, and you'll be a low noise promoter. If you go up to very high accuracy, you can stay a low noise promoter. But in most of the phase space, your noise will the noise that you end up with will essentially be an increasing function of the amount of variation that you meet across conditions. And you can actually write down that basically the total noise that a promoter will end up with is essentially the variance of the desired levels of this promoter times the fraction of those desired variations that are not explained by the regulator. Okay, so if a certain regulator has a certain R squared with your desired levels, 1 minus R squared times the original variance is sort of the variance that's left, that's not explained by the regulator, and your noise will be tuned to that level. All right. And you can also ask what will be the signal to noise level of the regulator, so that this phase transition is where that signal to noise level goes to infinity, but you see that here is signal to noise, optimal signal to noise is 1, so for most of this phase space, you want actually regulators that are fairly noisy. All right, so the summary of the theory is that not only the condition dependence of a regulator, but also its noise transmission is a functional consequence. Whenever regulation is imperfect, right, whenever your R is not very close to 1, noisy regulators are preferred. And the higher the variation in desired expression levels, the higher the coupling to regulators, even random regulators, and the higher the final noise level of the promoter. So I think what I personally like about these ideas is that it makes me understand how you can evolve gene regulation. So when people talk about gene regulation, it's often implicitly assumed that regulators and targets have been finely tuned to each other such that the regulator implements the precise requirements that the target have. But you may ask, okay, how do you get there from a state where there's no regulation? Right? How would you ratchet yourself up, make the regulator and the binding sites and tune this all? And this basically gives you a path how to get there through small evolutionary steps, because we've seen that genes can often benefit from coupling to regulators that only act to make the gene's expression more noisy. And you may start out by doing this, and then step by step, both the regulator and the target may evolve in small steps to make the relationship between what the regulator is doing and what the target wants more precise. All right. But you should recognize that if you're a regulator, you may now get promoters coupling to you that have different desires, and you will never be able as a regulator to satisfy all these desires, because different promoters will have different desires, and then there will be selection pressure for you not to be too precise, but in fact be noisy so that you can surface lots of guys. All right, so I'm basically finishing up. So it's very easy to extend this theory to many targets and many regulators, because it's all this Gaussian stuff. I can write down the equations, no problem. And I would like to do that to say something about the statistics of the kind of sort of solutions one would expect if you have many of these things. But where I'm sort of stuck with this, and if anybody has ideas, I'd be happy to know, is that I have very little understanding of what is sort of the correlation structure of the desires that different promoters have, right? So we know that some promoters are going to have the same desires. They want to go up and down together, and some promoters have different desires. But what the correlation structure is, I have no clue, and that's going to crucially determine the statistics I'm going to get.
What do you really mean by desire?
So in each environment, there is an optimal expression level for a gene, and that's the desire of that gene in that
environment. So that's what I'm wondering. You haven't much mentioned the environment, but is that what you are?
Right.
You are thinking about tuning to some variable
yes.
nature in the environment.
So there is lots of environments, and in each environment, I can give you a vector that says, if you tune all the expression levels to these levels, that's the best you can do. So I'm assuming that there is such a, you know, optimal vector of expression levels in each environment. Okay. And the question is, what's the correlation structure of that vector across environments? That's going to determine what kind of things I expect to evolve.
Very stupid question.
Yeah.
Are you talking about temporal noise here, or noise as being different from one organ, one bacteria to another?
So we take a snapshot, and so that's what we measure. But you can also look through time, and so we believe that the correlation time may be one or
so
more generations.
Across a number of different organisms.
Yes, that's what we do.
So couldn't you repeat the first experiment you described in 10 environments and begin to get at this?
Yeah.
Is that a crazy amount of work?
You mean the just measuring the noise levels?
Yeah.
No, I have somebody doing it right now.
So won't that bring you to some of this correlation structure right there?
No, because I don't really know what the, I mean, I could see what it is that the genes do in different environment, but I don't know what it is that would be their optimum.
So if you were a pan selectionist, this would be the answer.
Yeah, but I'm not.
That's fine, but I just want to understand how
right.
close you're coming. But really, what about fluctuating environments?
No, I'm talking about fluctuating environments. All of this is about fluctuating environments. Okay, so the whole idea is that the environment is not constant, it fluctuates, and your promoters, the fitness that it contributes, is some sort of geometric average about what it does across all these environments you encounter.
And that's right. I mean, I quite agree. So maximizing geometric mean fitness is what this is all about.
And that's what this, yes, that's what I've been calculating.
So can you use it in a reverse way, sort of from the observed promoters to see what the amount of frustration in these environments might be?
How would I do that?
It sounds very cool,
but how would I do that?
Your problem. That's my problem.
it seems like there's one other selection that there would be during this optimization process. It would be for cells in a given environment to expand the range where fitness would be good, that they should be able to live with noisier expression of a particular gene.
Right.
Because that increases
yes.
the geometric thing.
Yes.
So this is another thing
yes.
driving
very
more
good.
Noise.
Yes. I'm assuming that this, whatever the fitness function is, it has a fixed curvature around its peak. You're saying, well, but isn't that open to genetic modification? So yes, I haven't looked at that at all. All right, so maybe if I can just...
Oh, yeah, sorry. I just have... There's something with Regulon DB I'm just curious about. If I recall correctly, many of those transcription, so-called consensus transcription factor binding sites were very similar, with lots of N's, a few T's and A's, and variable sizes.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious as to... This seems to be an inherent plasticity already present within... unless we've come further in defining these transcription factor binding sites better.
So this is what I've been doing for a living, yeah. mostly, look at transcription factor binding sites and so on. So yes, you can say how many bits of information is there in a certain motif and how easy is it to get and so on. I mean, I'd be happy to talk about this, but I don't think that that's relevant for these. It says something about how easy it is to evolve these sites mm-hmm. and how easy it is to lose them and so on.
And also redundancy. So an inherent implication would be redundancy within these transcription factor binding sites. So
yeah, that is how easily you lose them. You can do certain mutations and you won't lose them. That's true. Yes. Michael.
So when you talk about an optimal expression factor, it sounds to me that you're assuming static conditions or an equilibrium.
No, in each environment.
But can you extend your theory to complex developmental programs like sporulation, where you have a regulatory cascade, where genes turn on and off, and to result in, say, differentiation?
Yeah, I might. I don't know. I have to think about it. Sylvia.
I have the feeling that you might have different equivalent solutions to optimizing fitness or
yes.
fitness by tuning the average and the variance.
Yes.
Could you imagine like a competition experiment between two strains, one of which has, I don't know, a high variance,
yes.
and the other one?
Yes.
That can, like in a cyclically changing.
Yes, you could do that. You could do that. We haven't done that yet, but you could do that.
So what would you think would be the preferred solution?
Well, you know, I would hope that the kind of the sort of formulas that I'd be calculating would give you a hint on what is to be preferred, depending on what kind of variation you introduce, right? So I will just say this one more thing to follow up. So as you, in my previous talk, right, I was talking to general properties of genes, right, substitution rates, and I showed that they negatively correlate with gene expression and so on. And so you may ask, how do noise properties of genes correlate with these sort of features? So that's what we did. So we collected for each gene, you call a set of statistics. So the DN, the amino acid substitution rate, DS. What is the protein level? Its RNA level. How conserved is its promoter? This is coming from some earlier work we did. So how much evidence that there is purifying selection on the promoter? How many regulatory inputs according to regular ODP? How much expression plasticity, I showed this before, and then the mean and promoter excess noise that we measured. Interesting. So then you, for any two of these quantities, you can calculate correlations, right? So this is DN against protein expression level, and this is this famous negative correlation between the evolutionary rate and the expression level of the protein. But here, for example, you see that the conservation in a promoter and its expression plasticity, I mean, how much it varies across the environment, has some weak positive correlation. So you can calculate the whole matrix of all correlations, and then you can do PCA on the matrix and say, okay, so what are the main components that you
see? Correlations are statistically significant.
Yes.
Do you think they're biologically significant?
Depends on how you define biologically.
You know, this couples to that, this is affected by this, this is affected by that, this is affected by that, everything's correlated.
I do think that this Bilke and Drum story, I do believe that. I do believe it's a higher express than this misfolding.
But would the story suggest such a weak correlation?
Yeah, because there are many, many other things, and they're not in there. It's just one out of many factors that affect it. That's what I believe.
Yeah, but any of the... everything's additive, a little bit in this and that, then the methods for trying to disentangle things, okay.
All right, so this is the last thing I'll show you. So you can do principal component analysis of the correlation of all the gene statistics. So the first principal component, that's this axis here, that's the well-known, on the one level is RNA and protein level, on the other end is DNDS. Okay, so the first principal axis separates genes by those that evolve fast and have low expression level, or ones that evolve slow and have high expression level. That's the first principal component. But the second principal component has promoter noise, regulatory inputs, and conservation of the promoter on the other end. So the second principal component of gene statistics says promoters that are very noisy evolve their regulatory regions fast, and promoters that keep their regulatory regions the same have low noise. Okay? That's the second statistical trend that you can see in these expression data. So I thought this is interesting. So it's sort of orthogonal to the DNDS expression level. All right, so that's it. I won't tell about this. So thank you.
A couple of days ago, you said something about the evolved promoter similar to a known one.
Yeah.
Can you say something about it?
Well, okay, so that's this, but
That was the problem.
I'll talk to you.
We should probably.
Yes.
Yeah, so we four, have no? talked at four by Gwen in the small seminar room.
Okay.